Good evening and welcome to the History Show on RTE Radio 1. Today we're on location at the home of some of the most comprehensive and fascinating documentary material in the National Collection.
We were told that known Secret Service men and certain British Army officers would be shot in their lodgings the next day. Cullen said to me that he was going to Croke Park the next day to see a match. We told him to keep out of it, that it was madness to go there.
As we continue our series on the War of Independence, today's programme is coming from the facility that has prompted a huge upsurge in local and national research into the revolutionary period, the Military Archives in Cahalborough Barracks in Rathmines in Dublin.
I thought at first they were going to shoot me, but they took me out and closed the door, then grabbed my hair and then proceeded to cut off all my hair to the scalp with very blunt scissors.
Since the digitisation of the Bureau of Military History witness statements, the military service pension applications and the IRA brigade activity reports, online access to a treasure trove of documentation from the revolutionary period has been available to academic, local and family historians.
Ammunition was our most serious problem, and I don't think we ever possessed as much as an average of 30 rounds per rifle. Captured ammunition was, of course, shared out at once, but a fight in which no ammunition was captured was, in effect, a calamity.
So much of what we know about the War of Independence comes from this repository. The 1913 to 23 period is one of the best documented of revolutions, largely because of the thousands of files stored here. Today, we'll find out more about how these collections came about, how they're stored and collated, and what they tell us about the Anglo-Irish War. We'll be talking to the people tasked with the preservation and the dissemination of this collection, and to archivist Katrina Crowe about the inestimable value of what's being maintained and organised in this military facility in suburban Dublin.
In 1923, after the Civil War, Pierce Beasley requested that a temporary Department of Army Work would be established by the Chief of Staff in order to collect the records from the period in question, from the War of Independence and Civil War, but it didn't get the go-ahead because the Chief of Staff's argument was that while there was so much demobilisation and reduction going on at the time, it wouldn't be feasible or realistic for him to set up an additional department at that time.
Captain Daniel Iotis, officer in charge of the Military Archives, traces the institution's history back to the end of the Civil War. The functions of the archive include the maintenance and storage of the post-War of Independence military pension application files and the witness statements of the Bureau of Military History. The Bureau itself was established in January 1947 by Oscar Traynor, then Minister for Defence, and a former Commandant of the IRA Dublin Brigade. The object of the Bureau was to, quote, assemble and coordinate material to form the basis for the compilation of the history of the movement for independence from the formation of the Irish Volunteers on the 25th of November 1913 to the 11th of July 1921. Unquote. The latter date was the eve of the truce that brought hostilities to an end in the War of Independence. But its origins go back well beyond 1947 and to something called the Anglo-Irish Conflict Project.
In 1933, the Minister for Education, Thomas Derrick, suggested that the Department of Defence initiate a project to collect and preserve the records of the War of Independence, and that these would take the form of witness statements which would be compiled and deposited at the National Library. However, his proposals didn't really take hold properly until 1942, when Robert Dudley Edwards approached the Taoiseach Éamon de Valera about such a project and authored a memoranda on the subject on behalf of the Irish Committee of Historical Sciences.
So all of these things are feeding into what eventually becomes the Bureau of Military History. But is it J.G. O'Connell, Ginger O'Connell, is he the man who really, really gets it off the ground, or am I wrong there?
Well, J.J. came in the late 1920s as the director of the second Bureau, under which the military archives fell. So that went on to become G2, and it's now its military intelligence. He did attempt to initiate such a project during the late 1920s, but he didn't get the go-ahead from the Chief of Staff. He came out of the second Bureau and was replaced for, I think it was 3 years, by Colonel E.V. O'Carroll. It was during E.V. O'Carroll's time that the Anglo-Irish Conflict Project was initiated. And again, this was a project to collect the testimonies of officers who had pre-truce service. However, there was a lot of goodwill behind this. it didn't come to fruition. And in 1935, which is the first instance of the military archives existing in and of itself on the establishment as part of the Second Bureau, and J.J. O'Connell comes back as its director, upon realising that the Anglo-Irish conflict project wasn't taking off, that they weren't getting the feedback that they wanted, J.J. O'Connell wrote to the Chief of Staff, "Sir, as a result of recent consideration and assessment of sources for the history of 1913 to 1921, I have come to the conclusion that the most valuable existing source at the moment is constituted by the 1924 pensions files."
So he could see in 1935 that the pensions files were going to be important, because to most people in 1935, pensions files would have been pensions files. I mean, nobody would have cared very much. They're just people looking for money. But he could see.
Exactly. So I suppose through the Anglo-Irish conflict project, there was a foreshadowing both of the Bureau of Military History, which was, I suppose, basically the Anglo-Irish conflict project done properly, and also by looking at the sources available and how they were doing it, they analysed the records that existed and came to the conclusion that the pensions files were the best position to provide such a history.
So at what point are people sent out to the highways and byways to begin collecting the memories of veterans of the War of Independence?
During the Anglo-Irish conflict project, this was done by correspondence. So a letter was issued by the Chief of Staff instructing that all officers with pre-truce service provide a written testimony to the Bureau. Now, looking at the files, Colonel O'Connell and his assistant staff officer, Captain Niall Harrington, they received a lot of positive intentions from people. So there's lots of correspondence saying, yes, I will get on to that as soon as possible or as soon as I can. Some people basically said they hadn't got the time, and some people said, well, I basically can't remember anything. So there was lots of good intention, but I suppose because it didn't have the formal structure that the Bureau had later on, it really didn't come to anything, and people didn't really submit those testimonies as they said they would.
And why is it that the Bureau, when it is established, is able to get so many testimonies and is able to get so many important testimonies?
My own personal kind of idea around that is that particularly Michael McDunphy was a rather skilled administrator and a forceful character in himself. It also, having a formal establishment rather than just corresponding with people in the hope that they would get back in touch, was why it was successful. So it was organised properly, again, with the backing at the highest level from Oscar Traynor as Minister for Defence at the time.
For most of us, however, awareness of this treasure trove of material has peaked since the collection was first digitised and placed online from 2010.
The Bureau of Military History was made available to the public by the joint efforts of Commandant Peter Young, after whom the reading room that we're in is named, and Katrina Crowe. So they basically knew of this collection, lobbied. They were both fans of access to records, so they made their case to the Department of the Taoiseach, and they had them released, and they were deposited then with the military archives. The reason they were digitised is, I suppose, both a matter of access, to give access to as wide a public audience as possible, and accountability. And also, I suppose, for archivists, it's a matter of preservation as well. If documents are digitised, it reduces the amount of physical handling they need to undergo.
The Bureau of Military History is a remarkable collection, physically speaking. When we finally got permission to release them, and this was in 1999, Peter Young and I, who'd been banging on about this for a very long time, along with a number of historians, were finally summoned to the Department of the Taoiseach one September morning.
Archivist Katrina Crowe on her involvement and that of the late Commandant Peter Young in making this unique collection accessible to the public.
And we went in and we were told that we had won our battle and they were now going to release the Bureau of Military History, and could Peter make arrangements to transfer them to the military archives. Hallelujah. We went and had a whiskey at 12 o'clock in the day to celebrate, because this was just a great moment. And he died a week later. That was the last time I saw him alive. No, it was a great last time to see him alive. But he was 49 years old. He had a vicious heart attack. And it was so sad.
Between 1947 and 1958, a total of 1,773 witness statements were assembled by the agents of the Bureau. So how was this material collected?
So they'd go out and they would have an initial meeting with the veteran and kind of maybe look at, OK, what do you want to talk about?
Hugh Beckett, one of the civilian archivists in Rathmines, took me through the process, which would begin with the identification of a willing veteran and the setting up of an interview.
And then see if you want to either start writing yourself, put together witness statements themselves, or whether it'd be like an interview process and they get the typist in and all that kind of thing. So that'd be the the start of the process, and if they wanted to carry it on, they'd go back again, get a further installment, because some guys were happy to talk forever. So, you know, you'd have statements be 300 pages long, and then others would be 2 pages.
And what kind of assurances were they given about these statements and about what was going to happen, these statements?
Yeah, it was kind of generally agreed that these statements were going to be closed, they're going to be locked away, held safely in a strong room in government buildings, and they weren't going to be open until at least 30 years had passed, if not longer, was the kind of promise that was given, which made veterans much more willing to actually give a bit more information than they might have otherwise.
Did they get a veto on the final statement?
Yes. It'd be kind of a draft would be sent out to them and say, well, what do you think? Is there anything needs to be corrected? Are you happy with how it's going so far? So that would go back to the veteran. They'd have a look, make their notes, it would go back again. And then the next draft would come out and say, are you happy enough with this? And once they reach the point where they're happy with it, that's the only point that then they'd sign it.
And is there parallel documentation from the people who are conducting the interviews or conducting the investigations or whatever, where they're actually commenting on what they're getting from the veterans?
Yeah, there would be. There's kind of investigators' comments, they're called. So it would usually be kind of like a one-page document saying who the veteran was, where they're based, what they're talking about. And then there would be a section where they kind of say how their memory was, whether they're embellishing, if they had an axe to grind, all sorts was in there, you know.
So all of that kind of stuff is in there. So if somebody is, as far as the investigator is concerned or the interviewer is concerned, talking rubbish, that will be down in a separate document.
Yeah, pretty much, because I think they knew it was going to be closed for 30 years as well. So they made some of the comments were kind of, you'd have, this person strikes me as very odd, and comments like this. So they obviously weren't too afraid to say what they thought.
The whole business of how the Bureau can be judged as a balanced version, I suppose, of what happened, comes down to who said yes and who said no. I will not give a statement to the Bureau. Now, some people said no because they didn't like De Valera, whose idea this was. Some people said no because they didn't want to revisit the events of the time. Some said no because they said they couldn't remember. So you have a variety of different things. There's a wonderful moment in John McGahern's Amongst Women, where Moran, who's the protagonist, the very strange father of all these daughters, is visited by a friend who says to him, ah, now, would you not apply for the old cheque? Sure, it's a great thing to see it landing on the mat during the winter when times are hard. It staves off trouble. And he said, I wouldn't give them the satisfaction. This was a guy who took the Republican side during the Civil War. Many of those remained unreconciled, even after De Valera comes back into power in 1932. They're not having it. They feel that the whole thing has failed and they're not going to get engaged. We don't have that much evidence of why people didn't and why there are notable absentees from it. But we can gauge certain things. And certain people have told us in their memoirs why they didn't want to do it. But if they didn't want to do that, they still wrote a memoir, if you like, to give us some version of their side of the story. So again, handle with care. This is not a record of everybody who fought in 1916, the War of Independence or the Civil War. There, some of the notable absences are dead people who were really active. One of the most notable absences is Eamon de Valera, whose idea it was to set up the Bureau, and who kept saying, yes, he would make a statement, he would make a statement, and hadn't by the time he died. Just never got around to it. Which again, if we wish to be psychological, we can ask ourselves questions about Dev's possible remorse about the treaty negotiations, about Michael Collins's death, about a whole bunch of things. There were other things he could have been remorseful about too that he probably wasn't. But is that what held him back? Was he going to have to deal with too complicated a story to be able to get it right? And it was just too much for him as he got older? Who knows? But he is certainly notable by his absence, as are many others.
The establishment of the Bureau gave individuals involved in the War of Independence a chance to record their own stories in their own time and in their own fashion. Members of groups such as the 1916 Volunteers and Irish Citizens Army, and subsequently the IRA, Cumann na mBan, the IRB, Sinn Féin, and influential individuals not associated with any specific organisation, were sought out to provide as broad a range of commentary as possible. to Katrina Crowe, the witness statements, though sometimes mendacious, inaccurate, or downright idiosyncratic, are an invaluable historical source for the 1913 to 23 period, as are the files of the Military Service Pensions Collection, a growing number of which are now also online.
The Bureau of Military History is an oral history of the Revolution, taken between the late 40s and the late 50s, quite a time away from the events that it's describing. And you need to be very careful about interrogating these statements in terms of faulty memory, which is something that comes to us all, alas, possible settling of old scores, which we can see in some, lack of interrogation of your own capacity to remember things or not. One of the most interesting statements is Louise Gavan Duffy's statement about 1916, where she was the only person, by the way, who challenged Pádraig Pearse about the moral probity of taking over the GPO and shooting at people. He didn't listen to her, but it was this interesting moment. But she constantly peppers her statement with, I think, I'm not sure about this, but it's possible that it may have been so-and-so, it may have been so-and-so else. So she is a wonderful testimony giver because she doubts her own memory all the time, and it means we trust her more. Contrast that with Vinnie Byrne, who was in the squad, 75 pages of unapologetic, I plugged him, I gave it to him, on and on, without any self-examination about whether he might remember these things correctly or not, and certainly with no remorse for anything he did. He's a classic soldier following Collins's orders, which is what he did. So there are contrasts all the way through. It is hopeful that a very key part of that collection, the investigator's notes, will be put online shortly, which will allow us to know what the people who interviewed everyone for the Bureau thought about the quality of the testimony they were getting. That in itself will make this already a hugely influential international archive about conflict, an even better one about the processes of oral history, which is increasingly becoming a source for historians all over the world, but it has to be handled with care. Now, in the case of the Military Service Pensions files, it's a miracle that they survived because they moved from a dreadful location near Park Gate Street to possibly a worse one in Cailleachas na Cuivéin up in Glasnevin, where I first encountered them in an attic, thrown about the place in the worst possible disorder. And they were saved by Peter Young and Pat Brennan, who later became the director of the project overseeing them, and made their way here. And they have survived remarkably intact, given their terrible history. But what we've got here are records that come from a very different motivation. These are claims for pensions for action from 1916 to the end of the Civil War by people who were active in the field, as it were, in conflict. So their emphasis is military, not cultural, not social. Nonetheless, because of the ancillary material that you get in them, they become a semi-social and sometimes cultural history of Ireland during the period. So the first lot of pensions files begin in 1924. The second large tranche are 1934. So 1924 and 1934, in the case of the Military Service Pensions files, are much closer to the events that they're describing than the Bureau records are, which means they should be more trustworthy, at least in terms of what people's memories are. Now, of course, everyone has something to gain from getting a pension. They may be inclined to over-egg the pudding and say they did things they didn't do. To counteract that, you have a very severe referee and advisory committee that requires three references to say, OK, you say you were at the ambush. Give us three people who can swear that you were there and who are trustworthy. That had to be done. So the level of verification is really high. Also, the level of disappointment is really high because it was hard to meet those conditions. As you can imagine, people fighting in a guerrilla war and then in a civil war where things were chaotic. A lot of records weren't kept. People died, so they weren't there to give testimony as to the validity of people's statements or not. But they give us an unparalleled look at the detail of activity during the War of Independence particularly and the Civil War. They also cover 1916. But funnily enough, in Ireland, as you know, once the anniversary is passed, we forget. 1916 won't be interesting again for a very long time. It had its moment, and the same will happen with the War of Independence and the Civil War. So we have one chance to get this right as historians, as archivists, as a public that wants to interrogate its own troubled past, and it is a troubled past, and that will be these years of anniversaries. So we'd better make the best of it. And I think we will, and I think we'll be really hugely helped by the fact that we have these extraordinary sets of documentation, probably the best in Europe in terms of the documentation of a revolution. It's hugely to the credit of both the government and the Department of Defence that the archival project to keep producing these records and putting them online, cataloguing them to the highest state of the art, that they have made that a priority for the decade of centenaries. That need not necessarily have happened. Other things might have taken over. But in fact, we know and we can see what an effect they're having, both on scholarship and on communities who are interrogating these files as they come online, discovering new things. And I must say, I've always had faith in the capacity of the Irish people to accept new, puzzling information about the past, even if it raises more questions than it answers. They're fascinated by it. They want to then pursue things further. There'll always be a very tiny minority that wants certainty of a black and white nature about what happened in the past. Most people are sophisticated enough now to understand it's not like that. There will be fragmentary memory. There will be missing documents. There will be people who don't tell the truth. All of those things will be there. But the best thing we can do as a state that has now a wonderful military archives here in Cahalbrough Barracks is to make this material available with as much contextual help as we possibly can and let people make up their own minds about what actually happened.
This is what an official state does. There's a legacy there after World War One with the French and the British Army to be seen, to be taken care of their own veterans, either through pensions or maybe support to find employment post-war.
Cecile Gordon, Senior Archivist and Project Manager of the Military Service Pensions Collection Project, on why a newly established state, with few resources and a damaged country to repair, allocated hundreds of thousands of pounds of taxpayers' money towards pensions for former IRA veterans, many of whom were still in their 20s.
Symbolically, it's important for the new state to also be seen doing it. They obviously want to make their mark as the official authority, also as the legitimate successors of the people who, the actors of 1916 and of the War on Independence. Another factor as well is that we have evidence of that in the file of William James Stapleton. The Military Service Pensions Act, the first one anyway, was introduced in reaction to the army mutiny in 1924 and its aftermath. And I just want to read you the couple of sentences. It's a typed document signed by M. Crotty, which we think is either Department of Defense or Army Finance Officer, and it's November 1925. The Military Service Pensions Act was no doubt introduced principally for the purpose of dealing with pensioners who severed their connection with the army at the time of the crisis and who may in future participate in any undertakings hostile to the interests of the state.
That's you're buying people off, basically.
Pretty much to keep quiet and calm, yeah. So it is, the pensions is the carrot or the tool to assuage people who might become a problem in the future.
Of course, one way of saving money on War of Independence pensions was to limit the scope of the 1924 Act that introduced them.
The first Act is restrictive, it's limited, and it's entirely one-sided. To apply under this Act, you had to have served in the Civil War in the National Army, that means pro-treaty, and you should have served either in 1916 or in the War of Independence during two periods prior to the truce, and these two periods are very important. So the 1924 catered for pro-treaty, was politically discriminatory and was not open to women applicants either. So Kuhnemann was completely not even considered.
This is then rectified when? In 1934?
Yes, in 1934. In 1932, Fianna Fáil comes into power and they seek to establish a new Military Service Pensions Act that would cover their side of the Civil War, the anti-treaty side. The Act will also expand to cover the members of Kuhnemann. So obviously the rules apply to women to be eligible for pensions would differ greatly from men who would be directly involved with the enemy in a fighting capacity. And what's very important during the 1934 Act is the introduction of the definition of key man. Key man would be a person who is not a fighter. So anything from engineers, dispatch riders, intelligence officers, without whose work basically the fighting could not have gone on. The 1934 Act is very important. Obviously, a lot more applications certainly are coming in. So the women, the anti-treaty side, but also all the ones that have been rejected during 1924. So by December 35, the referee and the advisory committee are hit by something like 51,000 applications. And they work until July 47 on this. At the enactment of the Military Service Pensions Act 1949, everybody comes back, the referee, the advisory committee are reconstituted, and they work until the end of September 58.
And are these people mostly skinflints? Do they mostly want to prevent people from getting pensions?
I don't think, after 11 years on those fires, we don't find that there's, you know, a systematic bias at all. But what you can say, it was restrictive from the start. I mean, it was hard from the start. The verification is one thing, but it was not open to all members of all organization. It was very, very strict. And generally speaking, where the people are turned down is because technicalities, they don't fulfill the legal requirements set out by the acts. What we have to understand as well is the definition of active service is changing as the acts are passed. It's not the same in 1916 than during the Civil War. And people were confused by that. The definition is complicated. You're not on active service if you're just a member of the IRA. There are certain things that you have to have done. But again, there are cases where you could say, I really struggle to find any political bias. But some cases, some people are hard done by.
If you think that an ancestor of yours may have been involved in these events, the place to start would be the 1911 census, which is the nearest census to the decade that we're describing. Find that name. You should be able to locate them. You probably need to know where they came from, at least the county, and you can narrow things down. There are all kinds of tips now from people about how to navigate the census records. And I emphasize, and it's really important, all of these records are available free to access. There is no paywall. And again, Ireland distinguishes itself by having that policy towards its digital cultural heritage. So you start with your name. From that, you should be able to get a proper address for this person, their age, their marital status, names of members of the family in the household, what kind of housing conditions they lived in, how many rooms in the house, were there outhouses and farm settings around it, details about their neighbours, details about the area in which they lived. So you have a lot of good, solid demographic and contextual information before you go near anything else. Then, armed with that, you go to the Bureau website where you can search by name and you pop in that name. That should bring up not just a statement made by that person, should they have made a statement. Not everybody did choose to make a statement to the Bureau people for all kinds of reasons, many of them political. If you find that, it's pay dirt because it's their own account of what happened, and you can read that for yourself. But even if they didn't, somebody else may have mentioned them, one of their comrades in a particular activity, somebody who was in their brigade. Many people may have mentioned them. So you'll find a whole range of references to other statements where this person's name comes up. Next step after absorbing all of that, and that will be a big moment because it is fascinating to read the words of a person who was actually there and who's connected to you, and people get a big emotional lift out of that. Then you want to go on and see if your ancestor made a claim for a pension. At this stage, you probably know, although not necessarily, whether they were on the Free State or the Republican side in the Civil War. If they were on the Free State side, the 1924 Pensions Act would have covered them. They excluded anybody who fought on the other side. If they were on the other side, you'd start in 1934 with the Pensions Act there. But in any case, the search engine for the Military Service Pensions files responds to putting a name into a box and looking to see what comes up from that. So what you should be able to get is a considerable file with an application from your ancestor. In 1924, it's just a straightforward paper application that tells you where they were at the time, what they did, with verifiable references from people who were there also. And you will also get details of what the kind of pension they got and why, what was the way it was graded. If you're lucky enough to have a 1934 ancestor, you will get a transcript of what they said at the hearing. And they are like reading a play, because you get all kinds of interesting things. And you get that priceless thing, which is the quality of a person's own voice and words coming to you. So that's a much higher order of excellent information, I suppose, than the 24 Act. With all of that, you will end up with a really interesting set of documents about this person about whom you may have known very little before you started.
Archivist Katrina Crowe on how to use the Bureau of Military History witness statements and the pensions collection. Back with more after the break.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back. You're with The History Show, coming to you today from the military archives in Rathmines.
The success which attended the movement was due almost entirely to the great support rendered by all classes of the people. It is to be noted that at no previous time had there been such an overwhelming demonstration of support by the people as there was during that period.
W.T. Cosgrave on the widespread popular support for the rebel forces during the War of Independence. That's an extract from a recording on the website of the military archives. It's one of a dozen recordings of prominent figures from the period, made in collaboration with the Folklore Commission in the early 1950s. Hugh Beckett, civilian archivist, explains.
So it was about 1951, they decided, right, we'll try and come up with a limited number of people to get voice recordings because, well, money considerations, they couldn't do too many. So that's why they went, right, we've got to get as many of the really important people as we can, just to give an idea of what they sounded like.
When it comes to what they sounded like, Maud Gonne is one of the most extraordinary ones, isn't she?
She is. She's so posh. The perfect line. She talks about her transformation from a carefree society girl to like a focused lady and who's going to sort out everything to do with Irish freedom. But, oh, it's perfect just to hear the voice, and she speaks so perfectly, so clearly. It's a great, great resource to have.
Evictions I saw in 1885 changed the whole course of my life, transforming me from a carefree society girl into a woman of set purpose. I was determined to do my share to free Ireland from the British Empire. I think it was Parnell who said, England's gifts to Ireland were workhouses, prisons, and lunatic asylums.
Sean McKeown is actually addressing his court-martial, isn't he?
He is, yes, yes. It's his full speech from his court-martial. We have the handwritten draft that he had, that he brought to for the trial. So it's great to hear him just read it out again, giving the full kind of emotive strength behind it from the time. It's fantastic.
Officers and gentlemen of the court-martial, when you opened the proceedings this morning, I told you I was an officer of the Irish Republican Army and claimed treatment as an officer. But, gentlemen, you are here to try me not as an officer, but as a murderer. And why? Just because I took up arms in defence of my native land. Defence of one's native land has ever been a privilege to the peoples of all nations, and all nations have demanded the services of their sons as a right. Be sure that the principle, which is a proper principle for the Yugoslavs, the Czechoslovakians, for the Belgians and the Serbians, is equally a proper principle for the Irish.
The military archives also house another unique collection, the papers of Michael Collins, Minister for Finance and Director of Intelligence from 1919 to 1922.
The papers of Michael Collins have been held by us for a very long time. We actually think it's one of the first collections that was taken in by the military archives in its earlier guise in 1924.
Lisa Dolan is Head of Readers Services, Education and Outreach and was involved in processing the collection.
It's a collection of two halves, because the first part of the collection, which would chart a lot of Michael Collins's early appointments as Director of Organisation, Adjutant General, and before he became Director of Intelligence, they're in a bad state. The reason being, we can link the provenance back to in the early 20s, and the material came in to J.J. O'Connell, who was the officer in charge of the early military archives.
From the Collins family, or where did it come from?
No, we don't know. There's a description saying that the material came in from a lady who had described the documents as being buried and at some point in a suitcase. So even, you know, evidentially what we can see is there's a lot of water damage to some of the documents. Mm. Some of the text is missing.
Yeah, I'm just looking at mm-hmm. photo stats of some of the documents, and yeah, they are in a fairly dismal yeah. state. I mean, obviously these are not things that, you know, any of the members of the public are going to be allowed to handle.
No, we've digitised everything now to really high quality for preservation reasons, but also to promote wider access. So we're hoping to put the material online very, very soon.
Is the material here, is it all very functional, or is there any personal material? Are there any personal notes from Collins?
Yeah, it's a really good question, actually. I suppose the point that I'd like to make is this material is very reflective of Michael Collins doing a certain job. So you get glimpses of his personality. He's, you know, sometimes referred to as a workaholic, a perfectionist, somebody with a zeal for perfection, in fact. That does come across in some of the dispatches coming from him. He can get a little bit fed up if his instructions aren't being followed, or if replies aren't coming quick enough, or if reports aren't returned on a regular basis.
Now, this is an impatient man.
It is. It's, well, I suppose it's somebody that's, you know, he's wearing several hats. But I mean, some of the dispatches would be dated to Christmas Day, New Year's Eve. You know, it's a man that doesn't really stop. There is a sense of humour that comes through as well at times, but I wouldn't have crossed him.
But you have to assume that the real gems of the collection went to the grave with Collins, because he was the kind of person, the kind of job that he was doing, a lot of this stuff could not be written down.
It's true. And I would imagine as well that a lot of the gaps in the collection, you can see by some of the condition of the early material, it didn't survive, possibly. It could have been destroyed. So the message could have been carried across and then destroyed.
Among the gems of the collection is a series of files related to Collins's work as Director of Intelligence.
We have 28 files relating to Dublin City and County Intelligence, dates from kind of the late 1920s, and it goes all the way up to 1922. So what we have is one particular file, and it's called PALS. Now, I mean, I don't know if PALS means, you know, friendly people. It could do, or it could be an abbreviation for something else. But what we do is we have a list of people that would have been working for Collins, and their identities are protected, and they're identified only by a code number. They yeah. are in touch.
Office,
yeah.
Somebody, Land Commission office, yeah. name is R,
yeah.
man in touch 100.
Yeah.
So presumably the man in touch is one of Collins's
yes,
agents.
Exactly. And what we have in this particular file series as well is observations or intelligence signed off by these people that are identified by code numbers about information that they've gleaned from their sources. You know, there's people in even just social kind of places, like there was a cafe that a Miss Russ ran, and it was apparently a favourite hangout of the Cairo gang. So there was friendly people or pals in a lot of different places.
Board of Works, yeah. Inland Revenue, Four yeah. Courts, His Majesty's Stationery Office, yeah. St John's Road. Yeah. They were everywhere.
Exactly. How many pens were they using?
The most recent material to have been digitised are the Brigade Activity Reports, which offer a detailed picture of the actions undertaken around the country by local IRA units. To illustrate the importance of this collection, archivist Michael Keane has chosen to look at a report on the activities of the IRA in Belfast.
First of all, here we're looking at what they call an explanatory statement of special circumstances connected with the national struggle in the Belfast area. That's the heading of the document. And basically what the Belfast Brigade are anxious to do here is to set out what they saw as the special circumstances which affected them in their service. They're eager that special consideration be given to them and to their members in terms of how the pension committee actually deal with their application. So they're setting out, for example, the situation that they were facing. They say we were opposed by 64,000 in terms of their enemy, as it were, composed of British military, RIC, ABC specials and the Imperial Guard. They also talk about the fact that, of course, they were fighting amongst what they call a hostile civilian population. And I suppose in Belfast area at that time, I suppose something like maybe 65% at least of the population would have been unionist. They also refer, of course, to the fact that the type of fighting which took place in Belfast was very, very different to the rest of Ireland, both in terms of the intensity and the time that it happened. So basically the heaviest fighting in Belfast took place during what we call down here the truce period. very intense, very heavy, a lot of casualties. And I guess the last point they're trying to make is that even then, this is from about 1935, 1936, that their members are, of course, still subject to harassment, if you like, from the RUC and from the police force, as it were, that they find it difficult. Even the simple act, which most other brigade committees can do easy enough, gathering records together, sending down the information to Dublin, what have you, things like that, they can't do. Because if these papers are caught, the Northern authorities are likely to use them as a basis for arrest.
I would imagine even something like a letter arriving with a harp on it, for example, could have been highly problematic even in the 1930s.
Exactly, and you find that both on the brigade activity files and even on individual pension files, where arrangements have to be made. So an intermediary, say someone based maybe, I don't know, could be Dundalk, Monaghan, somewhere like that. The material is going to them. They are then bringing the material up to whoever it may be, Belfast or what have you, and vice versa coming back, because the risk is just too great.
Now, you've got another document here. There's about 4 pages, and it's just a list of names.
This is another document that was, again, submitted by the Belfast Brigade to reinforce their claims for special consideration. It's basically the list of those killed during what I suppose they would have called the Belfast pogrom. So the first date is July 21st, 1920, and it goes all the way up into 1923. It's a list of 455 individuals killed. It gives you their names and addresses, male and female, and also, interestingly, names of Catholics, Protestants, whether they're in the police, in the British Army, what have you. Very, very few, if any of them, seem to be actually IRA members. The vast majority are other members of the population, what have you.
There are literally hundreds of names here.
There are, and I suppose it just goes to show, and this is what the point they were trying to make, the intensity of the violence and the fact, and you can see as it goes through this, that, of course, as they were so intent on making clear, there was no truce, as far as they're concerned, in Belfast or in Northern Ireland, indeed, generally, that the violence continued very heavily, very severe, and quite a lot of casualties.
It's an incredible example of, I suppose, diligence as much as anything else.
Exactly, because they would have had to go into, I presume, the local libraries or the central library in Belfast and comb through the newspapers of the time to get this information. It's not like today where everything is, you know, you can Google or whatever. This took an awful lot of work to do.
People's impression of some of the well-known figures like De Valera, Collins, were so different. I felt it must be very difficult for historians to get at the true picture of personalities, because it's a very subjective thing when people give their impression of how they found them.
Mary Burke, an employee in the military archives when the Bureau of Military History witness statements were being collated in the 1950s. Along with a colleague, Maura White, she's been recording her impressions of that period. Civilian archivist Noelle Grothier describes the jobs done by both women.
Mary was in the archives one day a year or two ago just on a research visit, and it just came up in conversation the fact that she had worked for the Bureau of Military History in the 1950s. And the military archives is running an oral history project. It began in 2015, where we've been sitting down mostly with veterans or families of veterans, asking them about their service or their connection to the defence forces. But this interview is slightly more unusual in that it linked back to a collection that we hold here and that's regularly accessed by our researchers anyway. So we've been chatting to her and her family over a number of weeks and months, and it emerged that there was two ladies basically who had worked for the Bureau in the 1950s who were still in contact, who were willing to sit down and chat to us about their work and about the project. So in March of this year, one of our interviewers sat down with these two women. Interestingly enough, we had a file on their employment and timekeeping and things that way. So they're able to check things like when they went on holidays in the 1950s. Things like that act as an aid memoir. They remember kind of what they would have done or what the work was involved. So it was basically just a conversation about what work for the Bureau was like. Maura had worked as a typist. Her role was to compile the witness statements as notes and drafts were given to her. And Mary worked as a writing assistant. So she worked directly with Michael McDunphy, who had been director of the Bureau of Military History. She worked on contemporary documents, which are widely relied on by historians nowadays.
Paddy Brennan, who was the secretary, was excellent. He was a wonderful civil servant. He was a kind of copybook civil servant. Everything had to be done right, and he had a personal interest because he was the youngest brigade commander in the Dublin area in his day. He was born in 1900, so he was 21 in 1921. Mm. And I would say he was intrepid.
Paddy was a very brave man. He was a big, big man. But he ran the Bureau very well, and he had an interest in it, that everything should be done well and that all the statements should be well presented.
Actually, on that, can I ask then your impressions of Michael McDonfee?
Michael McDonfee. Well, Michael McDonfee, now they represented the two sides. He was Free State. Paddy Brennan would have been Republican. Michael McDonfee was secretary to the president at that time.
Yeah.
He combined the two jobs, director of the Bureau, along with that. And we never knew when he'd come in. He'd come in when he could. Mm. We'd just hear his door banging and we'd know he's in. We better sit up straight.
So the Bureau closed in the 1950s. It stopped actively collecting work from the public. A lot of the staff were in the civil service. They moved on to different appointments and locations. Mary says herself that she actually moved on to a different office in statistics. There was a government decision that the material in the Bureau needed to be indexed. And Mary was one of the staff who was brought back to assist Patrick Brennan in indexing the material.
And we were given a room in government buildings, in the stables of government buildings. And our strong boxes, which no doubt you have here, were stored in the strong room in the basement of government buildings. And when we wanted one to work on, we had to have it brought up. I think it was terrible work ringing up and getting people to get it. And they were treated like gold dust, the archives that we collected.
Another potentially revealing and enlightening source of information for students of the War of Independence is the Medal Applications Collection. Rob McAvoy is one of the archivists charged with the preservation of this material. War of Independence service medals were issued with or without an attached bar. To merit the attachment, you had to have been at the sharp end of proceedings.
The medal without bar was a lower standard. The burden of proof wasn't as strong on the applicant. And it was introduced sort of to make some recognition of those veterans that had made service but didn't actually meet that same qualifying standard.
So if you could prove that you had been involved in certain actions and if that was verified by somebody who was known to have been a commander of a local IRA unit, you would get a medal and you would get the bar with the medal. If you couldn't reach that standard of proof, what kind of things would you have been doing between 1917 and 1921?
Well, a lot of those who received a medal without bar, it's essentially for membership in 3 months leading up to the truce. So that would be their usual activities we sort of classify as drilling, taking part in parades, you know, sort of more rudimentary activities as opposed to those who are actually out on...
digging holes in roads and mining bridges and stuff.
Exactly, yeah. As opposed to those who are actually out taking part in what was deemed like active service.
And were many people actually turned down for a medal of any kind?
Yeah, we know that about just over a quarter, so in the medals database, 12,900 of those applicants were rejected. Obviously, there's a number of reasons for this, but the vast majority of those are going to be rejected on a lack of evidence. And the one thing that we have to bear in mind is this is 1940s, 1950s, this is introduced. So we're talking about 25, 30 years afterwards, we're starting to see some of the veterans are passing on. And therefore, it's not as easy for an applicant to reach that standard for a medal. So that's why we see some rejected.
We're in a different space than we were. It's easier now to manage to say perhaps some disparaging things about some of the decisions that might have been taken, not partisan disparaging things. I would hope that we can look back at this period with the help of these archives and others. And at the end of 5 years, we can say, job well done. We have come through this with a degree of passion and compassion about what happened in the past. We care deeply about our history in Ireland, but we also need to care deeply about those who suffered from the consequences of it. And I think what we have is a really unparalleled opportunity over these next 5 years to examine all of that and to come out of it as a mature society that may even get to the point of understanding and interrogating the fact that the two major political parties in this country right now are products of the Civil War, and that we have never overcome that division. And there are many questions, of course, that you could raise about that. But it has had such a profound effect. Those 5 years had such a profound effect on the future of this country thereafter that we really have to look at it in as much detail as we can. We're enabled to do that by these extraordinary archives.
That's it from the military archives in Cathalbrua Barracks in Rathmines. We'll continue our examination of the War of Independence on next week's History Show. My thanks today to the Department of Defence for their cooperation and to Captain Daniel Iottis, Cecile Gordon, Michael Keane, Rob McAvoy, Lisa Dolan, Hugh Beckett, Noel Grothier and Katrina Crowe. Research was by Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE Radio. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.